Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of education, entertainment, debate, discussion, and dialogue, and answers to your questions via email and telephone. In a few moments, I'll be giving out the phone numbers, but before that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, there were a couple of interesting stories in the news today, and I think I will roll out with those. First of all, a recently published report released by the Food and Drug Administration looked at more than 800,000 women taking different forms of birth control from the years 2001 and 2007. And unfortunately, one of the more popular forms of birth control, a pill called Yaz, had a 75% greater chance of experiencing a blood clot than women taking the older birth control pills. The culprit would seem to be the progesterone component in the pills. Yaz and Yasmin and a number of other pills, which I'll list at the end of this, all contain drosperinone, which is a synthetic form of progesterone that increases potassium levels in the blood. We know that. It's possibly related to the effect of increased blood clots, although no one's quite sure. In general, what we think is going on with the blood clots and estrogens, or hormones, I should say, when you take synthetic hormones, or natural hormones for that matter, they have to be broken down by the liver. The liver is what is responsible for producing blood clotting proteins, and somehow the act of breaking down these hormones stimulates the production of increased numbers of blood clotting proteins, leading to hypercoagulation. Now, why would that be, you ask? Well, the answer is pregnancy. In pregnancy, women are much more likely to have blood clots. And of course, because birth control pills effectively simulate a state of pregnancy, it stands to reason that there might be an increased blood clot risk in pregnancy and birth control pills, and indeed there is. The fact that it is higher with the newer birth control pills, which supposedly have fewer side effects, is disappointing and will probably have a negative impact on the third quarter of the pharmaceutical company Bayer, which makes this particular set of birth control pills. Other birth control pills that would contain this component include Bayaz, Safrayel, Sieta, Lornia, and Zara. So we'll just kind of put it out there that if your birth control pill contains drosperinone, you might consider switching to a different birth control pill to decrease your risk if, all things being equal, you don't have side effects with the older forms of birth control containing levonorgestrel. Now, let's file this next story under, is this any way to run a healthcare system? Here's an example of the so-called free market at work in healthcare. We are currently experiencing a significant shortage of chemotherapy drugs, particularly the inexpensive generic chemotherapy drugs. In fact, in a recent survey, 25% of oncologists indicated that an error had occurred at their site because either of the drug shortage, and often because of inexperience with alternative agents, which of course have complicated dosing protocols. And if you're not used to using them, you know, you blow one little decimal point, particularly if you're using a calculator, because you don't notice errors when you're using a calculator as much. And you can, you know, really mess things up and lead to a complication. Also, what's happened as a result of these spot market shortages is the emergence of outside vendors and informal distribution networks. All of these vendors are unregulated, and the markups are up to 3,000% for cancer drugs because, hey, what the traffic will bear, right? If you can get it, why not get it? Now, what's driving this? Well, it's an unintended consequence of Medicare trying to lower the cost of cancer chemotherapy. See, prior to 2003, and we've already talked about how Medicare pricing works, well, Medicare's very much in favor of procedures. If you're an oncologist, you don't have many procedures to do. But what you do have is the ability to sell chemotherapy agents. So up until 2003, oncologists would buy chemotherapy agents themselves in their offices and stock them. And then they would sell them to the health insurance companies or Medicare, frequently Medicare, because, hey, people over 65 have more cancers. Well, that worked out to be quite a substantial markup. And in many practices, it was 50% of the practice income was this sort of retail turnaround on the chemotherapy agents. Well, that was a scandal in Medicare circles, and everybody's looking to reduce costs. So after 2003, what they were allowed to charge was just the average wholesale price plus 6% for office overhead. Well, that may cover your office overhead, but it doesn't cover your profit margin. But it wasn't a requirement in this new regulation that you had to use generics. So what happened was that oncologists, in order to keep their income up, started turning to the use of the more expensive agents. Think about this. 6% of $10,000 instead of 6% of $500. Yeah, and 20-to-1 is about the generic versus proprietary variation in prices. So what happens with that? Oncologists start buying less generics to keep their income going. Since they're getting a percentage regardless of the total cost, that reduces the volume of generics, and generic manufacturers are obviously working on a high volume, low unit cost or low unit profit kind of model. So they start losing money on the manufacture of these agents, so they stop manufacturing them. So the generics go poof. And in a misguided attempt to control costs, Medicare has not only increased costs to the taxpayer, but they've also led to a very dangerous situation of profiteering and shortage. Like I said, is this any way to run a healthcare system? So turning to emails, I have an email from Rika, who does not give her location, and she's asking about extreme hair loss. This is a long email, so I'm going to really chop it down and give you the Cliff's Note version of it. And effectively, for about a decade, what this woman has noticed is that when she takes natural hormone replacement for her menopausal symptoms, within a couple of months, she begins to lose hair quite substantially. And she has stopped the hormones, had the hair loss stop, rechallenged, and had this happen 3 or 4 times. So she's pretty convinced that for some reason, natural hormone therapy is leading to her hair loss. And she has all sorts of nuances here. But ultimately, Rika, I do think there is a solution for you here. I believe that the reason that you're experiencing this hair loss is because the testosterone in your formulas, or the progesterone, which can be converted to testosterone, is turning into dihydrotestosterone, which is, of course, a common conversion that occurs at the skin. Dihydrotestosterone does 2 things in the human body. In the case of men, it leads to increased size of the prostate, and it leads to male pattern baldness. In women who carry the gene for male pattern baldness, rather than losing their hair from the forehead back and starting at the temples, or from the top of the head out, which is called vertex baldness, they lose their hair diffusely as thinning. So, Rika, your solution might be using one of the agents that are used to block the transformation of testosterone into DHT. That way you might be able to have your hormones control your hot flashes and your other discomforts and still keep your hair. Natural substances that do this are saw palmetto and nettle. Unnatural substances, the drug Proscar, sold as Propecia to men for the prevention of hair loss. Now, that would be a very off-label use of that pharmaceutical, but one that I think would be a appropriate off-label use if you're willing to take a side effect risk and recognize that this is kind of a guinea pig thing that you're doing because the drug has not been used or validated in women. I think I'd stick with the herbs first and see what kind of effect I got. This next email from Terry in Petaluma. My father is 88 years old and has peripheral neuropathy. He can still walk, but his balance is marginal. He's beginning to lose feeling in his legs. What do you suggest he do to prolong his ability to walk? Well, Terry, many people develop peripheral neuropathy, which is a loss of sensation in the longest nerves of the body, the legs and to the feet, first. Ultimately, they can also develop numbness in the fingers, but it's those long nerve tracts that have a problem. The first thing that should happen is your father should be checked for tertiary syphilis. That's a simple blood test. It is not an uncommon cause of neuropathy. It's quite rare now, but it's probably going to make a comeback. And syphilis made a comeback, so I do think it's worth checking for that. He should also be checked for methylmalonic acid and maybe not just a B12 level. This is a mistake that doctors often make. They check a B12, it's 400, that's within the range of normal. So B12 deficiency is dismissed as a cause for neuropathy. But it turns out that even if you have an adequate blood level of B12, you may not be processing it properly. And that can lead to neuropathy all by itself. An elevated methylmalonic acid, which should be a byproduct of B12 metabolism, and when its levels are high, it means that B12 is not moving forward properly. That can be circumvented by using B12 shots. Another thing that I would recommend for anyone with peripheral neuropathy is to use a form of folate called methylfolate, or alternatively folinic acid, rather than just plain old folic acid, and to consider, in addition to that, the use of a balanced B complex. You want to be sure that you don't take more as an elder than 400 micrograms of folic acid, but you can take higher doses of folinic acid or the methylfolate because those have bypassed the bottleneck in physiology that leads to an accumulation of folic acid in the bloodstream, which has been linked in one study to increased cancer rates. So we don't really want to go there until we have more information. So let me go to one more email. This one from Anonymous in Carmel. When I research nutritional information, I get contradictory results. In your opinion, what would be the most accurate resource to answer such questions as, should nuts and seeds be soaked before eating, why, and other related questions? I would appreciate a referral to a website as well as a nutritionist. I've become a vegan and now find myself losing a little weight, and therefore I'm trying to eat high-calorie plant foods such as nuts and avocados to maintain my weight. Thank you for your vast knowledge. Thank you very much, Anonymous in Carmel. Well, to start with, websites, yes. That would depend upon the type of information you're looking for. And unfortunately, when you're looking for food-related information, it's kind of like, which church do you join? There's a lot of emotion involved with food. There are some excellent websites. The Mayo Clinic has a very good section on vegan diets and cautions and precautions for that. And anyone who is a vegan has to be very clear that they are getting adequate B12 and that they're absorbing it. So getting that methylmalonic acid level is something I automatically do in vegans. Not everybody can be a successful vegan. Soaking nuts and seeds increases the bioavailability because it opens up the cell wall and makes it possible for your enzymes to get to the fats and the carbohydrates and contained in those. In beans, it's particularly important, and I think we all have experienced the effects of when you eat beans that haven't been soaked versus when you eat beans that have. The amount of undigested carbohydrate going to the lower intestine generates a large amount of gas, which is a noticeable symptom. With respect to nuts and seeds, the same concept applies. A good way to consume nuts and seeds that really allows them to be fully bioavailable is actually as nut milks and using a cup of nuts and really blending that up with several cups of water just to taste is an excellent way to increase your nutrition. The use of olive oils, healthy avocados, olives, things like that, very important as you move away from protein as a primary source. One really needs to increase the fat. If you just increase the carbohydrate and be what I call a carbo-vegan, you're really asking for trouble as far as diabetes is concerned, especially if you do that long-term. So hopefully that was helpful. I'm going to take a moment and give you a bit of a book review. I've received several requests to recommend more books. This one is a little bit off the beaten track. It's called Fit Soul, Fit Body, and it's co-authored by Brant Secunda, who is a shaman, and Mark Allen, who is a triathlon champion and a 6-time Ironman winner, which, you know, you got to figure that that guy knows how to exercise. And it's really kind of an unusual fusion of concepts using shamanism effectively to improve athletic performance and athletic performance to improve spirituality. At first, it seems a little odd. And, you know, I kind of opened it thinking this seems a little vaguely exploitative. But as I got deeper into this co-authored series of essays, I began to see how at least the first half of Fit Soul, Fit Body actually makes a number of interesting points. The second half is dedicated to a diet and exercise program and is substantially the same as any other self-help, conditioning, and exercise book that you might encounter. But the first part makes some interesting points, which I want to highlight for you. First of all, exercising too hard is counterproductive. It actually taxes the system, particularly if you're going for longevity and endurance. Harder is not better. Longer, yes, perhaps, but harder, no. The second point is that since trance is a state of heightened internal focus, skill at entering a trance state is actually quite useful in transcending the usual barriers to fitness. Things like boredom and pain, for example, come to mind when I think about long-distance running. Overall, I would say the psychological and physiological principles are sound and explained in clear, simple terms. The book is Fit Soul, Fit Body, and the authors Brant Secunda and Mark Allen. And probably not coincidentally, I received this book in the mail from the publicist for them. They are doing a retreat seminar in Santa Cruz next weekend. The website for that is fitsoul-fitbody.com. If you're interested, go ahead and make a call. And again, I would say that if you're looking to get a kickstart on fitness and you have some background in spiritual practices, this might be indeed a book for you. Let's go now to Julie in Soquel. Hello, Julie, and welcome to the program.
I have a question. My adult daughter, for reasons that are complicated, has gone on to the Candida diet. And I am very concerned. She was not ever terribly heavy, and she has lost about 18 pounds in about 5 weeks, which seems to me very quick. And the way she understands this diet, she's basically not having any kinds of fruit, dairy, any gluten, and very few carbohydrates. And I'm concerned and just wondering, one, where do you get decent information about this and what you think about it? Or is that too general of a question?
Well, it's a good question. The hard part is that decent information is hard to come by. Yeah. This is one of these things where, how shall I phrase this in a way that is respectful to all persons concerned, which is, you know, one of my goals, one of my spiritual goals in life, is try not to diss anybody, even if I disagree with them. Okay, so let's start with this. There's a broad spectrum of opinion about whether or not Candida is a problem. And there are people who are true believers, very vehement about this, and have wonderful anecdotal stories about how their ruined health was restored by eliminating things that feed the yeast. And then there are people who say this is complete garbage. There's no scientific basis for it. And, you know, everybody has some Candida in their GI tract, so the presence of Candida is not a concern. Well, you can see what I'm talking about. With that kind of a variation, it's really difficult to find the truth. And the web is not the place to find the truth, quite honestly, because you can't validate the information. So when you go to the medical, respected medical sites, they all pretty much say it's garbage. And when you go to the alternative sites, they say this is, you know, this is the Holy Grail. So I come down, as you might expect, somewhere in the middle. I do think that there is a phenomenon called small bowel bacterial overgrowth, which when I read the symptoms of Candida, it's pretty much the symptoms of small bowel bacterial overgrowth. And since the treatment is the same, which is to reduce the carbohydrate or simple sugar, simple carbohydrate content in the diet, the fact that people get miraculously better when they follow the Candida diet to me means, well, that doesn't necessarily mean it's Candida. It could be this other recognized medical entity which has a similar symptom overlay. So that's problem number one, is misattribution. On the other hand, if you go on this diet and you have less bloating, less gas, you know, an improvement in bowel functioning and possibly an improvement in energy or other symptoms like sinus congestion or body aches, well, then you're onto something. You should stay on this diet. But the trick is to be on that diet and not lose weight. And I have looked at the Candida diets that are out there on the web, and I think that they have some really fundamental flaws. For example, it says no fermented foods. And I'm like, okay, why can't I have sauerkraut? That's a bacterial fermentation process. There's no fungus in there. It doesn't make sense to me that I have to avoid yogurt. although you could say, well, the milk sugar's a problem. Realistically, I think that the benefit of fermented foods probably outweighs any harm because they are replacing the appropriate bacteria that should be in your intestine, and that is going to have a more beneficial effect in reducing the ability of candida to overgrow. And I do think that there's probably some people who have candida overgrowth and that it's affecting their GI tract, but I just feel that there's a lot of murkiness and misattribution. So remember when I was talking earlier in the program about veganism, that's what I would recommend is more oil. Okay, one thing we do know for sure, candidas can't eat oil. So eating an avocado a day, for example, that's, you know, 400, 350, 400 calories right there. That'll help. Nuts, particularly walnuts and almonds, cashews, macadamias, increasing those in the diet. You have to do a calorie count. And so if she's really going to try to do this, she should maybe go and see a nutritionist and say, okay, how can I do this safely? Do me a calorie count, give me volumes and amounts so that I can follow this diet but not starve to death. I really don't like rapid weight loss. Listeners of the show will have heard me say before, you really put a burden on your body when you lose weight rapidly because you release a bunch of things that are dissolved in your fat and held there kind of harmlessly, and a great deal of environmental contaminants, VOCs, pesticides, hormone mimics from plastics, all of these things are sitting in our body fat, heavy metals from our fillings, and they're more or less sequestered and safe until you suddenly release them and the body's detoxification system has to deal with this burden. So she's not making herself healthier, and it's an extreme thing, and you're right to be worried.
Well, this is really helpful. You were saying earlier, I know you were talking about nut milk, where people, and is that kind of thing also useful, you think, for her?
Absolutely, and there's nothing in the nut milk that's going to feed any bacterial overgrowth or candidal overgrowth. So I think that's a really legitimate thing to do.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Lynn in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lynn. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a new listener. This is regarding a Morton's Neuroma.
Yes.
But I've done my homework, and I've seen a local orthopedic surgeon here in town, Dr. Norgaard, and I've also gone to physical therapist, and so it's on my right toe 3 and 4.
Classic location,
and
yes.
That's location. And then I bought the Vibrams and been doing beach walking. I'm 63 years old. As my PT said, get my feet loosened up.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been working on this for about a year, and I think I'm to the point where Dr. Norgaard said if you get surgery, you're not too sure that it's actually going to work or not. You know, it's really inhibiting my ability to regularly exercise. I do use an exercise bike, but still just it's getting more intense in terms of the pains in my two toes.
Okay. So I'm not clear on your question.
Number one, the question is the likelihood after having surgery that it will improve the condition or not?
Well, the condition itself has two components, okay? Morton's Neuroma is a lump on a nerve. And
yes.
Unfortunately, the lump is right between the heads of the metatarsals, the bones in your feet that form the arch with the ankle bones and then lead forward and connect to the toes. Where that connection occurs, the bones spread out and become kind of lumpy. When you think about a bone, you actually think about something that looks very much like a metatarsal, you know, a tube with knobs at both ends. Between those knobs, the nerve has to pass. And if the nerve gets traumatized repeatedly by tight shoes, usually, and bad DNA, you end up with a lump there, a scar, in other words, like a callus on the nerve. And of course, then it's even narrower and tighter. So the surgical procedure is actually essentially removing the nerve. So you end up with numbness distal to, that is to say, towards the toes, and you eliminate the thing that is creating the pain. So the nerve, ideally, under ideal circumstances, dies back and you no longer have pain, but you have some numbness in the area. So that's the price. It's the Little Mermaid kind of get something, you give something up dilemma. And yes, numbness absolutely happens if you remove the nerve. But maybe the pain goes away too, and so that would be deemed a success. The reason that you're getting a hesitancy on the part of the doctor is the phenomenon of spinal cord, let's call it reprogramming. When a person has nerve pain for a long period of time, let's say years, something very paradoxical happens in the spinal column, and the spinal column seems to develop wiring that perpetuates the pain even after you remove the thing that was triggering the pain. So it's almost as if you've trained the spine to be in pain in this area, and so it keeps sending pain signals to the brain, and it'll actually recruit information from other nerves to generate a pain signal. A more classic version of this is someone who's had, let's say, a bad disc, and then when they finally have their disc surgery, they're left with the same sort of pain that they had before the surgery, even though the nerve's no longer being pushed on.
Okay.
So that's the possibility. That's why you get failure. That can be backed out with acupuncture, particularly a form of acupuncture called Craig Pens, P-E-N-S, which is actually a patented trademarked name. You can look that up on the web.
Okay.
And that might be worth trying before your surgery to see if it reduces your pain on a short-term basis, because that would indicate, to me at least, that you have a lower probability of success. I always suggest trying acupuncture before you amputate, and effectively you're amputating the nerve when you operate on it.
Okay.
So try acupuncture if you haven't already done so.
I haven't.
Do a lot of what you're doing. I think you're doing good things. Wide shoes.
Yes.
You know, stop
probably.
Pushing on the nerve. And you may be committed to wide shoes for the rest of your life. I mean, if that's a problem, then yeah, exactly. At 60-something, you know, you're probably past your fashionista phase. And,
it's not a problem.
You know, giving up the Manolos will not, you know, destroy your life. So,
yeah.
So, you know, really good wide footwear that maybe with an orthotic that takes pressure off of the metatarsals. And I'm sure that Dr. Norgard's worked with you in this respect.
Yeah, I've got the orthotic and... And so I've been really, yeah. And I couldn't write down the type of acupuncture you said.
Craig, like the name Craig.
Oh, okay.
And,
I got that.
And
the
then
next
P-E-N-S, all in capitals.
Oh,
P as in Paul.
Okay.
And you can look that up. It's definitely worth trying.
Yes.
Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Dave in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dave, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for all you do, by the way.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
So what I want to talk to you about is I want to go back to the running theme, and this may be more of a question for my psychotherapist, but I'm 50 years old. I've been a runner my entire life, ever since college, since I was 20 years old. And about a year ago, I got really busy with work, and I kind of stopped running, just literally stopped running after almost 30 years of running, you know, 60, 70 miles a week.
Yes.
And so now my life is less hectic and I have the time. I just can't get back into it. I go out and try and I just can't make myself run again. And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts about that?
How long has been the interval?
About a year.
About a year. And you're how old?
I'm 50.
During that year, did you have any kind of major stress injury? It could be
nothing.
A shock, like losing a loved one or losing a job or anything like that?
No, nothing.
Okay. So the reason I ask that is because that sort of thing can be an effect on your endocrine system, particularly the adrenal gland. And after that sort of a shock, if you've really thrown things off and thrown off the balance, that could be a physiologic basis, but it sounds to me like maybe it's just an activation energy. So before you used to run alone, am I correct?
Uh-huh.
So maybe the first step might be to not do that, not try to run alone initially.
Well, I take my dog with me.
No, I'm thinking about a running buddy, somebody who is perhaps trying to start out or is in a similar situation. You might see if you can check around the neighborhood, someone who's maybe just doing some light running, and just kind of go out and have conversational, social running, not goal-directed, distance
right,
running.
Right, so I'm not thinking about the running.
Exactly, so that you're distracted. Another possibility, maybe just getting through the first 20 minutes is usually what it takes for the physiology to shift. By your period of not running for a while, that latency has recurred. Previously, when you started running, everything kind of dropped into a groove fairly quickly and you got into a zone and just kept running, right?
That's yeah.
And this time you're just not dropping into that groove.
Yeah, it's like the main thing is, it used to be I could just ignore the pain. I mean, obviously, running hurts, and I could just ignore the pain. It didn't matter. But now it's like all I think about is, oh, my God, my lungs.
All right. So distraction, and like I said, maybe starting off being a little less aggressive for the first 20 minutes and giving the endorphins time to kick in before you really stress your body.
That's what I'm missing.
You're missing the endorphins. Yeah,
yes.
They're not kicking in. Previously, you had your brain trained, not just your body trained, but your brain was trained. And so you literally got the hear the bell and salivate sort of endorphin response. And you've lost your conditioning.
Yes.
And not just physical conditioning, but also you've lost that mental conditioned reflex. And so you have to retrain it in. So starting out slow, doing a social run for like 20 minutes and then maybe saying, okay, sayonara, and then starting to push your body.
Okay.
Not getting yourself into pain before you feel that sort of relaxation response, which generally, like I said, kicks in at about the 20-minute mark. The other thing I want to emphasize that could have happened and made a big change, and I'll tell you a personal anecdote about this, is your hormone milieu of testosterone to estrogen balance may have shifted. And it is very possible that your testosterone levels have dropped from where they were a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
So get your testosterone and sex hormone binding globulin levels checked. I like to do direct total testosterone rather than unbound testosterone for technical reasons I won't get into. But the bottom line is if your testosterone levels are in the lowest quartile for your age, then consider supplementation. If they're in the highest quartile, I'm barking up the wrong tree. In other words, the highest 25%, we're barking up the wrong tree. If they're in the lowest 25%, then that may be a change. Obviously, you don't have your previous levels to compare, but it's worth a shot.
Okay.
Now, the personal anecdote comes with something odd that happened to me when I went through menopause, which was I hated to run and could not run. Just was the same thing you're describing. Just, oh, my legs hurt. And it was just agony to run 2 miles. Subsequent to the shift in my estrogen testosterone levels, which occurs naturally in women at menopause, you know, I went from probably high estrogen, high 25th percent to low 25th percent, and I'm actually a high testosterone. But when my estrogen dropped relative to my testosterone, I found that I could run for 45 minutes and just slowly. I mean, it was not like major stuff, but it was a completely different experience. So I'm really convinced that testosterone relative levels to the other hormones is quite influential in terms of when you get that endorphin response.
Okay. So the other thing I want to stress is to anyone else listening, running is a lifesaver. Anyone who is on the fence, running is a lifesaver. That's all I can say.
Well, I will go with running is a lifesaver. Any kind of exercise that a person can get into and do regularly, but running has the advantage of pounding on your bones. And so for women in particular, it's a really good thing to do if you're cartilage will take.
Well, I mean, not only physically, but also mentally.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, and I hope my advice will be helpful for you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. And we're going to Joy in Ben Lomond. Hello, Joy, and welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. My question is about traveling while pregnant, specifically in underdeveloped countries, specifically in Central America. And what I know there's all the sorts of bugs you can get, like, you know, malaria and dengue fever and those more exotic illnesses. But I'm also wondering just about sort of the general, like, more common, like, traveler's diarrhea sort of thing, and something like that that might not affect an adult very much but could potentially be really harmful to a fetus. Is that true?
Well, the major thing that I would see that would be a problem with traveler's diarrhea is if you get one of the toxigenic forms of E. coli, you can get a fever. Probably the biggest contributor to birth defects is fever. You know, infants, particularly when you're early pregnancy. Later on, it's not so much of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might get preterm labor, but you're not going to get malformations of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But a fever in the first 3 months of pregnancy is a pretty significant thing and is greatly to be avoided. What stage of pregnancy are you?
I'm currently in the first trimester, but I would be traveling in the second, so I know it's safer then.
It's much safer because all of the organ systems, the major work has already been done, and they're in their growth and elaboration phase rather than their initial formation phase, which is much better. They've got much less chance of being messed up then. traveler's diarrhea is best avoided by good hygiene, avoiding salads and fruit, particularly street food. If you're pregnant, you really shouldn't. Ceviche, raw fish of any kind, absolutely off the table during pregnancy, because some of the parasites can and do circulate in the bloodstream, which means they'll get through the placenta potentially. So that's very important. Malaria is very, very nasty in pregnancy. So you want to be very cautious if you're going to an area where there is a significant amount of malaria. Now, traveling in the winter, probably not so much of an issue. But of course, when you get down there in the equator, it's the mosquitoes never really do stop. Because DEET is a neurotoxin and it does sink in through your skin, most people don't realize it, but DEET, the major ingredient in mosquito repellents, is actually closely related to DMSO. And they're both excellent vehicles and penetrate right through the lipid bilayers of cells. And so they get into your bloodstream. So I'm not happy with pregnant women using DEET either. If you're in a malaria area, that means basically you're in a mosquito net burka, which is covered with pyrethrin, which is a chrysanthemum-based entity, which is very toxic to mosquitoes, but unless you eat it, not going to be toxic to your fetus. For malaria, you know, you really do want to get one of those little suits. You've probably seen them. It looks like a baggy jumpsuit, except it's made of netting. And you're going to look dorky as all get out, so you just have to get over yourself on that one. Short of that, you know, you take your chances.
Yeah, that's what, I'm just trying to decide if I want to take the risk. You know?
I don't think you should. I mean, you can go to Central America next year. It's not that far. And, you know, why stress your body?
Yeah.
It's just, why take a chance? And good luck. Good luck. I know it's a tough decision, but you'll be foregoing a lot of life's pleasures after this baby is born. It will be worth it. I have it on good authority, but it is definitely a change in terms of the way you make your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And personal hedonism definitely takes backseat to to responsibility towards your babies.
Definitely. Thank
you. Okay, good luck. Bye-bye. Let me just go to one more caller. It's Jocelyn in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jocelyn.
Hi. Hi. I'm fairly convinced I've got an overgrowth of yeast in my intestines because every time I eat sugar, it just blows up and has all the effects, and I have all the fatigue and sick reactions to it. So my question is, do you think, I mean, I've tried to battle it with natural foods for about a year, but I'm ready to, I think, try nystatin or some other kind of hardcore drug to just eradicate it.
Well, you won't eradicate it. Eradication, it's like eradicating athlete's foot. I mean, you can keep it at bay. What you're really after is you're after a few candida spores that are not successfully setting up housekeeping and reproducing. And then you have to create those conditions and maintain them. Anybody who's got candida overgrowth, you don't get candida overgrowth without having something wrong with your intestines in the first place. Specifically, candida don't grow where the right bacteria are in place.
Well, I have cut out gluten and I've eaten a lot of probiotics, but I still have the occasional sugar, and that's the problem.
Well, you may have a mixed organismal overgrowth. How long after eating sugar does it take for you to start bloating?
Like 15 minutes.
Okay. So what that says is that's when the food is still in your stomach, and you're not supposed to have bacteria in your stomach at all, because your stomach is supposed to have low pH, which renders most bacteria dead or incapable of growth, with the exceptions being the acid-loving bacteria Helicobacter pylori, which actually increases excess stomach acid and leads to ulcers. So with that bacteria aside, most other bacteria are killed. You probably have a deficiency in your production of stomach acid, which is a very common and fairly under-recognized issue. So step one for you may be, at the get-go, restoring extra stomach acid. Now, they tell you in the candida diets, no vinegar, you know, because that's a fermented food. And I think that might be actually wrong-headed, but assuming that you want to follow those recommendations with the idea that, well, it's lore that's been built up over the years, so it's probably mostly right, which, by the way, is not how I look at it. But if you do want to go with that as a stance, then you want to replace your stomach acid using some betaine hydrochloride or something like that. Beyond that, you need to use something that is going to prevent yeast and some of these other bacteria from thriving in the upper intestinal pathway. And there are natural agents like oregano and undecanoic acid, and then there are things like the nystatin or even diflucan is used by some alternative practitioners. These are fairly heavy drugs, although nystatin, I think, is reasonably safe. It doesn't really absorb across at least the intact intestinal mucosa, so the chances of getting a toxic dose to the liver are really small with oral nystatin. The trouble with these things is that, again, you don't eradicate completely, so as soon as the conditions are right, lapse back into favorability for the candida, those spores are able to germinate and regrow. So you have to go after what's wrong with the host, and that's why I'm emphasizing the acid and the probiotics, and maybe the acid's been your missing piece.
I think so. I haven't tried that at all. So if I were to increase the stomach acid, it might help digest the sugar and the overgrowth of yeast?
I think you have to think in terms of ecological climates, okay? Let's suppose I am out there in the Mojave Desert, and I bring a redwood tree and plant it. You know, what are the odds that redwood tree is going to survive? Pretty close to zero, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't have the right ecology. You don't have enough moisture. There's too much sun, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ditto, I take a cactus and I live in the foggy belt of Felton and I plant that outside, you know, in the fall. What are the odds that cactus is going to be alive in the spring? Zero. So what you want is you want to create the intestinal environment that is like the desert to the redwood as far as candida is concerned.
Okay.
And that's not going to happen with one behavior.
Okay.
You need to shift the ecosystem. The fact that it's growing tells you that you've got the wrong ecosystem.
Okay, that makes much more sense than taking the diflucan and the nystatin. That's much better, so thank you.
You know, you can go out there with the Roundup and kill the redwood that way, but, you know, let's just use the analogy that you can kill it with the antibacterial or the antifungal, but if the environment is good for its growth, it'll reseed. So what you do with the Candida diet is you simply are trying to shift the environment by reducing food, but that's not enough to really shift it permanently.
Okay.
So you have to get somebody else filling those ecological niches and thriving. So it's the right probiotics, it's using prebiotics, it's high fiber diet, it's all of the above. Maybe it's also using some digestive enzymes. I don't know. You know, we're on the air and we're not going to be able to get down to that level of analysis. But you have to try and fix all of the things that are not there for the environment that you're trying to get.
No, that's perfect, because I'm doing all of that. It's just I'm eating sugar, too. So I think if I keep doing all the digestive enzymes and probiotics and everything and just don't eat all the sugar,
and
I'm
add,
good.
Yeah, and add the acid.
What is the acid? HBR or something?
HCl. So you'll look for it in the health food store under betaine, hydrochloride.
Okay.
And that's just a vitamin B that they use to match up with the hydrochloric acid to create a complex salt that can be rendered as a solid and digested.
And so it's just HCl?
Betaine hydrochloride.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dawn.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So here's an interesting science story, and it just goes to show that we don't necessarily know what we're doing with natural products as well. This is a study done in the Netherlands using resveratrol, and you'll remember that resveratrol is the compound that's found in red wine. This was a study of obese men, so it was a human study. They took 150 milligrams of resveratrol, which is a relatively low dose compared to what's fed to the mice in the original studies. Now, the original studies showed that resveratrol alleviates insulin resistance and protects against the ill effects of a high-fat diet in terms of cardiovascular disease. And it also seems to slow down the speed that telomeres are reduced. So the effects are comparable to what happens when animals restrict calories. If you restrict calories by about 30%, you delay the onset of age-related diseases. And in mammals, you can increase lifespan by about 30%. So 30% of calories, 30% increased lifespan. But quality of life, well, you try imagine eating 30% less calories for your entire life, and maybe it's worth it, but maybe it isn't. So the researchers gave 11 obese but otherwise healthy men a dietary supplement with that 150 milligrams of pure resveratrol, and they measured the amount of energy, their metabolic rate, the amount of fat they were storing and burning, and more. And like calorie restriction, resveratrol supplements lower energy expenditure. So essentially, they lower the metabolic rate, they reduce fat in the liver, they lower blood sugar levels, and they drop blood pressure. And this is very important, the way that the muscles burn fat was also shifted in this study in a beneficial direction. So one of the problems with insulin resistance is, ironically, you lose the ability to burn fat. That's the thing you want to be doing if you're trying to lose weight, is burning fat. So it is, I think, going to prove to be a very beneficial agent to be using in the metabolic syndrome patient. Now, because it decreased metabolic rate and changed the way fat is burned, it's not clear whether it will help people lose weight or whether it would lead to weight gain. And it could go either way when you look at what they observed in these people. And it wasn't a long enough study to actually tell the tale there. But I would suggest that if a person has metabolic syndrome, which is to say insulin resistance, high triglycerides, high blood pressure, and a waistline that is larger than 35 for women or 40 for men, measured at the navel, that you might consider this as a natural compound that would fit into the might help, probably won't hurt category. And if you do decide to do the 150 milligrams of trans resveratrol a day, I would definitely say monitor your weight. And if you're putting on weight while doing that, reconsider and stop. An interesting little tidbit about cancer. This was a primary research study. So this is on the lines of kind of a science lesson concept here. But up until recently, very recently, we've thought of cancers as being dependent on the mutations that occur within the cancer cell, and have seen it as a series of stepwise events which occur, progressively mutating the cell and leading to the development of embryologically present traits like the ability to stimulate new blood cells and the ability to migrate, loss of cell surface adhesion, things like that. And we've seen them as being primarily related to intrinsic qualities of the cancer cells. But this research seems to establish that there's a key role for the macrophage, the white blood cell in tissue that's kind of an amoeba. Macrophages migrate to the site of tumor growth. I would think of that as being a kind of a response to fight the cancer, and up until recently, that's what we thought it was. But it turns out that without that migration of macrophages into an area of cancer, the cancers actually are unable to become metastatic cancer cells. So the white blood cell, and I'm assuming this is a kind of accident of biology, is actually a necessary thing to happen. The macrophage has to be there for the cell to become metastatic. And that kind of talking back and forth between cells is really fundamentally new information. Where we go with this? Well, of course, the immediate thing that they do in this press release is they say, well, in order for the migration to occur, there's this protein called SA100A10, and if we just can come up with a block that would block that, we would stop tumor growth. Yeah, you would also stop macrophages from doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is fighting infection. You know, this is the sort of, I don't know, how shall I put it? We're justifying our basic research, which is very good research, with the idea that I think is ludicrous that we're going to invent a drug that will make a lot of money from this basic research. We have to stop thinking about messing up all of physiology at a level as intimate as the immune system in order to fight one aspect of the physiology, the cancer cell. Let's go to Peggy in Aptos. Peggy, you have a quick question?
Yes, a follow-up about neuropathy.
Go ahead.
Which I have at 87. Can I substitute ferrosulfate tablets for shots?
Ferrosulfate is iron, and you would only take iron if you were iron deficient.
Okay.
Iron deficiency is not particularly associated with neuropathy. B12 deficiency is.
Okay.
And whether or not you can get it orally would depend on whether you make something called intrinsic factor and whether you make stomach acid. And if you're on a proton pump inhibitor like Prilosec or Prevacid or something
which
like that, then you won't, because you are taking away the acid that you need to be able to absorb the B12 orally. There's a nasal spray which was recently taken off the market. I'm not sure why. I have to follow that up. Just heard about that. There are under the tongue tablets, which work in some people, and you have to monitor the methylmalonic acid levels to be sure that that's working. Your doctor may or may not have heard of methylmalonic acid. All of the neurologists have now heard of it. I definitely know it wasn't the case 2 years ago, but the awareness is out there now that that's really the best way to check for adequate B12, not B12 level, but methylmalonic acid.
Okay, so the shots are better. I should not take the tablets. I should go back to the doctor, and I'll go to my neurologist instead of my regular doctor.
You can do that. The main thing is you want to find out what your methylmalonic acid level is. If it's elevated, then you for certain want to lower it into the low normal range, and you're going to do that with whatever B12 supplementation method works. You could try under the tongue, but the first thing I would do would be maybe be a series of shots to get that level down and normalized. And then if it starts to creep up again when you're using under the tongue pills, then you know that's not going to work for you.
Will you tell me what kind of acid again and say it slowly? I'm not...
Methyl.
Okay.
Methylmalonic, M-A-L-O-N. So methylmalonic acid.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Next week, we have a program that will be a recorded program. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.